Image Doctors, July 20th, 2006. It's actually July 16th, 2006 for us. We're recording this live from Colorado Springs Security Service Field in Sky Sox Stadium. I'm Jason O'Dell.
And I'm Rick Walker.
And welcome to the ballpark, everyone.
Yeah, I think you could probably hear a little bit of the ballpark noise in the background.
Excellent. We're actually in the press box here at Security Service Field in Colorado Springs, which is home of the Colorado Springs Sky Sox Baseball Club. They are the AAA minor league affiliate of the Colorado Rockies.
Which is a major league team for those not familiar with baseball in the U.S.
That's right. So these guys who play for the Sky Sox will be the next in line to move up to the big leagues should they be called up by the Rockies.
Right.
Who play in Denver. Now we are here at a wonderfully warm and sunny day. It's about 95 degrees out right now.
Yep.
And we're going to shoot this game for you and check in from time to time with our experiences shooting some sports. So what we thought we'd do start off is talk about what our game plan is and what we brought.
Yep, and then we'll do some updates a little bit later on after we've been out there doing some shooting for a little while, and then we'll probably do a little bit of a wrap-up, you know, afterwards as well.
That's right.
So we are heavily armed, that's for sure.
We are armed for bear, or baseball as the case may be. We've each brought our 200 to 400 VR and D2X bodies, right?
Right, right, and 17 to 55 and 70 to 200 lenses as
right.
well, right?
Exactly.
That's what I've got.
Now, my guess is I'll be mostly shooting the big lens, but every now and then if we get some access into the dugout areas, I might want a shorter focal length just to get some more candid shots
right.
or pictures of the ballpark. One thing I learned from the sports workshop was trying to not just focus on everything that's necessarily the players, focus on the lighter moments, the fans, the atmosphere, the stadium.
Exactly.
And to take Dave Black's advice, treat it as if it were you were shooting a coffee table book. So we're going to try to do that. The fans are trickling in here at the stadium, and we're going to go stake out our locations for the shoot. So we'll come back in a couple of minutes. When you next hear from us,
it'll probably be seconds.
It'll probably be a few seconds from now on the podcast. When you next hear from us, we'll be reporting in from the game. All right, well, stay tuned. Okay, we're back. We've just spent the first hour down on the third base dugout. It's now the top of the fourth inning.
We had a celebrity location, the bathroom of the dugout.
That's right.
We just kind of holed up in there, which wasn't a bad place given how hot it is today.
If you are a fan of the San Francisco Giants, we were there with your AAA squad at their restroom. So
that's right.
That's pretty fantastic right there. So for all you
Handed
Dodgers
out
fans
towels.
Out there, we didn't
did
spike the
tips.
Water.
Yeah.
Anyway, we're back up here in the press box taking a break from the heat. So we thought we'd share with you our experience so far while we take in the game.
To do a metric translation to about, 36 degrees Celsius?
It's hot.
It's hot.
It's real hot,
yeah.
Especially if you're in the sun. Rick, what did you find? How's your experience going so far?
It's interesting. I feel like I've never held a camera before in my life. It's just incredibly different getting the rhythm down. And one of the things I was trying was the AF on button, which we had talked about in a previous podcast.
Right.
You'd learned about in one of the workshops and things like that. That worked great. That way you could get the focus set up on a pitcher or a bat or whatever, have it set and not active while the actual movement was going on, and just focus on getting the release at the right time and everything. It worked well.
Yeah, this is all about something we talked about a little bit before, about decoupling the AF on button from the shutter release button, so that if you put your camera into release priority and there's a steal at second and he's out at second.
Oh, yeah. Huh? The crowd goes wild.
The crowd's happy. And the base runner is going to go back to the dugout and take a seat here. But what we were talking about, the switching your AF on button and turning the autofocus off from the shutter release allows you to lock focus at any time as long as you're in release priority. And that means that you can recompose, and even if the subject isn't over the autofocus sensor, the camera will still fire the
Which
frame.
Which is important, otherwise it'll just lock up.
Right. It's hard enough to try to figure out the action in a baseball game, and then you started working on composing the shots to get a nice composition.
Like I mentioned to you when we were first starting out, I felt like I was trying to do an exercise where I was patting my head and rubbing my stomach at the same time.
That's right.
It really does take some coordination to make it work, and I'll bet you that out of all those shots, there's maybe one keeper.
Right. Well, now, Rick, are you shooting in RAW?
Yeah.
Yeah. I was shooting in RAW, too.
Compressed
now, we
RAW.
Do that because we're not good
Very
enough to
good.
Shoot JPEG.
Not in this kind of a situation.
And I've already filled a 4-gigabyte card.
Yeah. I'm still getting used to having a continuous advanced mode on my camera.
So this is different from landscape shooting a little bit.
I haven't shot as many as you.
Yeah, that's right. Now, we got a really bright, sunny day, so another thing that we're running into is, there's just a lot of dynamic range, and so the white uniforms of the home team, the Sky Sox, are getting a lot of burnt-out highlight speculars. Mm-hmm. Sometimes that's no big deal, but that's another reason why we're shooting in RAWs. We might be able to recover a little bit of those later.
I did dial in about a third of a stop minus compensation. That looks pretty good, looking at the histograms occasionally.
Right.
You don't get a lot of time to do that, though.
No. I think the biggest challenge of baseball is that while it's a pretty slow-paced game, when the action does happen, it changes sides of the field in a heartbeat.
Right.
You go from focusing on the batter or the pitcher to all of a sudden having to focus on and locate the action at the shortstop. And you can't always do that. So just focusing on one spot,
I remember that was a tip from your workshop that you were just at. Deciding what you're going to isolate on. I think that makes sense. I can see that so far.
Yeah, if you just want to work on, I'm going to focus on the second baseman now, and hopefully he makes a play, and you'll get lucky, and you'll get that play. Yeah. And it helps to know something about the game, too, where if you know that the batter is right-handed or left-handed, you have an idea if this guy's a pull hitter or where he might, his tendencies are. And that's something that if you cover a lot of baseball games and you start following the team, you'll certainly get to know the game.
Will be a good explanation for why we'll fail ultimately on the photos.
That's right. So anyway, that's our check in with you guys from the we're in the middle of the third inning, and we will be back in a little bit with some more insightful information, we hope. Back now from the
seventh
first
inning.
Base side.
Yep.
What do we got here? Bottom of the seventh. We just had our seventh inning stretch.
Yep.
And we are cooked.
We are very cooked. I don't think I've been this hot for quite a while.
For those of you who don't know, Colorado Springs is about 6,000 feet altitude.
Even a little bit more than that, yeah.
And when that sun hits you, there's not a lot of ozone to keep it from hitting you.
Nope.
So, we're pretty toasty right now.
It's a dry heat.
It's a dry heat. That's right. Yeah. I'm glad we're not covering spring training in Florida. That'd be really hot.
Oh, thank God. I definitely have a renewed appreciation for sports photographers.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, you're just out there. And a lot of times, you don't get a whole lot of breaks. You got to be wherever your spot is, and you can't give it up.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
Now, we've had a little luxury here. We've been able to move around the stadium pretty much wherever we wanted to go.
Yeah. Well, there's a nice crowd here. There's still open seats, so we've been able to move around, get some different positions. We've shot from both dugouts. We've shot from around third base, first base, behind home plate.
Yeah.
Some elevated positions.
Unlike some places, you can get behind home plate here, and it's an angle at most professional sporting events that you are not going to be able to get. So if you do get an opportunity, it provides for some unique angles. You can really capture the pitcher with the ball coming out of his hand.
Exactly.
Get that grip.
And that's an important thing. If you're interested in getting into sports photography, minor leagues or their equivalent around the world are a great way to break into it and get your technique down, because just as we were discussing earlier, it does feel pretty awkward at first. I'm still feeling a bit awkward at this point, although I'm starting to get in the groove a bit.
Right.
So some practice would be a good thing. And minor leagues are super for that.
Now, one mode that we've been using a lot, I noticed something that you probably don't use very often on your camera, is the high-speed crop mode on
the D2X. Absolutely.
It's very useful here. Again, we're not using the crop mode to get closer to the action. In fact, the 200 to 400 lens from these dugout positions is all the reach you need.
Yeah.
In some cases, it can be even more than you need.
Although generally it's been about right.
It's been pretty darn good.
Yeah.
But with the high-speed crop mode, we're using that to get a faster frame rate. And this is to try to, you know, when you want to try to get that shot where the ball is leaving the pitcher's hand or the batter is making contact with the ball. So those photographers who can do that on a regular basis are pretty darn good because it's a tough one to get. And so what else have you learned today from our little sporting adventure?
Well, I guess we should talk a little bit more about what we brought with us and how that worked. There's usually some interest in that kind of stuff. We were both shooting with those Think Tank Modulus belt systems.
Right.
With some of our lenses and another equipment tucked in there, and that worked well as we stayed mobile.
Absolutely. You know, you don't want a really heavy backpack for, I think, a belt pack or a small, you know, just a fanny pack even, if you don't have a fancy bag, just to throw a few things in there like your lens caps, teleconverter, whatnot. I brought my teleconverter, didn't need it.
Yeah, I didn't use it either. I had it as well, just the 1.4, but wasn't necessary.
And we did a little neat little twist on this one. We both brought the carrying case for the 200 to 400 VR. And that has the nice little feature of being able to strap a monopod to the side of it.
Yeah, and that worked pretty. That case worked pretty well today.
Yeah, it was nice. So we were both shooting off monopods, which also takes some practice. If you've never done that, you have to work on your stability in the lateral direction. Another thing I try to do today is change up between portrait and landscape orientation. There's a lot of good shots to be had in portrait orientation at baseball. When you're just focusing on the batter, I find I make a mistake. It's usually trying to get too much in the frame, and I should think opposite, which is get less in the frame and really crop in tight.
Yeah, exactly. I think that's true. And also, with the 200 to 400 having the VR feature, I didn't lock down the controls on my monopod. That way I could swivel it up and down. I've got, both of us have those little Manfrotto or Bogan swivel things
head
on them. That way I could move it up and down, and that was important. And I also kept the rotating collar loose on my lens, so I could switch between vertical and horizontal. And the VR was nice because it gave me a little bit of extra stabilization without having those things all locked down.
So one thing, we were shooting behind home plate, and you're obviously behind the screen.
Right.
And that brings up a neat little concept. I mean, a lot of you know this already, but if you're shooting with long glass, if you pre-focus on the distant object and you're close enough to a fence or a screen, autofocus isn't going to even worry about,
no.
It's not even going to detect anything from that screen.
Yeah, so I did the same thing. I pre-focused, got close to the right distance on my subject, and it just snapped into focus.
And a big strikeout for the Sky Sox here. And the crowd roars its disapproval. I could never be a sports announcer either. I don't know about that.
Well, what else should we talk about?
Well, we got some stuff, you know, coming up. We're going to wrap up today with a discussion of our last RAW converter on the plate, right?
Yep, Adobe Camera RAW.
That's right. And for those of you who didn't notice already, the trial version of Capture NX is now available, and we've actually started an anchored thread in the digital post-processing and workflow discussion forum where you can get some tips and tricks on some of the basics of using Capture NX.
Right.
So if you decide to download the trial, you might want to check that out just to get some ideas, because some of the controls you're going to find work a little differently than the ones you may be used to with Photoshop or some other program. So
yeah.
So check those out. So the question is, we're at the baseball game. Did we bring the right stuff? Did we bring too much?
We were pretty close. I used everything that I brought except for the teleconverter. I could have probably skipped the 17 to 55 in retrospect because I didn't use it that much.
Right.
Just a few shots.
Although if you're up in the stands and you're taking pictures of the players signing autographs, mm-hmm. it can be nice.
Oh, yeah.
But I agree. You could probably get by at a game like this with 70 to 200 and a longer lens. And in fact, at a day game like this, even if I had the 70 to 200 VR with a teleconverter, I would have been fine.
Yeah.
I could, you know, the only thing I maybe couldn't have done was get shots of the outfielders up close.
Mm-hmm.
But that would have been enough. So I shot mostly in shutter priority. What about
you? That's what I did too. I just put it on 1/1000 of a second, ISO 200, and kind of forgot about it. Yeah.
I did a little bit different. I used my auto ISO just for fun. Tried to shoot up around 1250th. In some cases, I was up around 1/2000 of a second. We'll see how they turn out.
Yeah.
We'll post some of our pictures on the blog.
I may not be quite as brave with mine. I'll see when I get home.
I'm sure you've got at least a couple of keepers.
Yeah.
One thing's for sure, I've got about 8 gigabytes of images I've got to sort through.
Yeah.
And a lot of people have been asking us for tips on workflow, and we can already tell you, if you're a sports photographer, the workflow is going to be very different than the one that we normally use.
Well, yeah, now... Yeah, not for us today so much, because what we'll probably do is
we'll
go through and
just
pick and choose
keepers, yeah.
and take the 3 shots that are okay,
right.
Those process those, and that won't take too long. But certainly if you're having to do a whole lot, you definitely want to adjust your workflow, use a tool appropriate to it, and it's probably a set of tools, actually.
Now, I can understand why a lot of sports photographers might shoot JPEG only. Simply because just the vast increase in card capacity that you
sure.
get in JPEG mode. Also, you increase your burst.
Right.
You can really shoot off a burst. Now, in compressed RAW, I think I was able to get a 25 shot burst in RAW with the D2X, because that's a 7-megapixel file.
Yeah, and I was honestly not shooting any burst that long.
No, neither was I.
Yeah, typical burst for me was, you know, maybe 5 or 6 shots, something like that. Don't know if that worked yet. Find out later.
I guess we'll have to learn.
Yeah. Okay.
Well, we're going to move on. We're going to follow up in a little bit. When we get back to the studio, we'll talk about ACR, and we will talk about some of the things that we've got coming up.
Yep.
So from Sky Sox Stadium, Security Service Field in Colorado Springs, we are the Image Doctors signing off. See you in a few seconds.
Yep. Back in cool temperatures again.
Yeah.
Back in the mountain lair.
For the remainder of the show, we'll go from the studio here.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure I'm dehydrated, by the way.
3 bottles of water didn't do it
no,
for me. I tell you.
It wasn't enough.
It wasn't nearly enough. But great experience out there at a baseball game. We recommend anybody who can get an opportunity, talk to your local, you know, minor league team, especially the lower level affiliates. You know, if you've got a single A or double A affiliate nearby you, you might be able to just score yourself a press pass or just get permission to shoot at a game.
And certainly thanks to the Sky Sox for allowing us to do
getting
us press passes.
Special thanks to them and their director of PR, Mike Hobson,
yeah.
for helping us out and letting us shoot the game.
Right.
And even if you can't shoot from the dugout, a lot of these minor league games you can shoot from the stands and they'll let you bring your camera in.
We could
have
gotten a lot of really nice shots.
Exactly.
At least theoretically. From the stands. We'll see how they yeah. All right, let's switch to the other topic, which is Adobe Camera Raw, or ACR.
And then we want to sum up our discussion of sort of what we've learned in the last few months of raw shooting mm-hmm. these different RAW converters. But ACR, Adobe Camera Raw.
Yeah. It's probably the converter that, along with Capture, Capture 4.4, I'm most familiar with at this point, because it was my primary RAW converter for probably at least a year and a half.
It's probably a RAW converter that a lot of people are most familiar with.
Yeah, absolutely. It comes with Photoshop CS2. It's just a portion of it. There's a version of it that also comes with Photoshop Elements 4.0.
Mm-hmm.
It's pretty similar. It's not identical, and unfortunately, we've just got the CS2 version, so that's what we're going to focus in on in this review.
So if you're using Elements and we talk about something that you cannot find, it's probably just because that feature isn't in Camera Raw.
There's some...
It's a more basic version, but it's pretty similar in most of what we.
And certainly the way it processes the file will be identical.
Yeah.
Not completely.
Right. Now, like most of the raw converters out there, it uses what are called sidecar files, where it takes the processing settings and puts them in a separate little small file, not a big
like a
one.
Text file almost.
Mm-hmm. That's the normal mode of running ACR, and or at least the most common one for most people. And as a result, it's pretty quick on conversions.
And saving and mm-hmm. file saving settings, cutting and pasting settings, any of that. It's only got to write those little sidecar files.
Right.
So it's almost instantaneous.
Yeah, so from a workflow standpoint, it's very nice. I think it's one of the easiest to use raw converters if you're looking at high workflow, high volume kind of stuff.
Because mm-hmm. it's integrated with several of the Adobe applications.
Right.
Photoshop and Bridge.
Right.
So Bridge is your browser, and you can apply ACR settings from Bridge as well.
Mm-hmm. So one nice thing with it is if you go into a specific image and it's got parameters that are slightly different looking than other ones, but functionally they're pretty similar. You'll have a slider as well as some pull downs for different white balance settings. That's not too terribly different than most. It's got some sliders for something called exposure, shadows, and brightness. And while they're not precisely the exact same thing as the three sliders you'll find in a levels control, you know, where you set the black point, the white point, and the mid-range gamma, it's
pretty
if
close.
If you think of it that way, it'll be pretty close.
Right.
And then it's got a slider for contrast that just applies a S-curve to the image and will either make it lower contrast or higher contrast. And then it's got a slider for saturation. Those are all in the mm-hmm. the main panel that you see at first. Now, one important thing.
That's the adjust tab.
Yeah,
people,
that's the adjust tab.
Which is what comes up by default when you open it.
Yeah, the important thing is that, and I'm sure this is probably the case within the Elements version too, its original default is for automatic settings. And I got to tell you, and this is true for almost it's
for all of them.
All of them. I'm not really fond of the automated settings. Sometimes they work, but a lot of times they give you results that just look very overprocessed, in my opinion, just kind of garish and not too good. So the thing I would recommend is, unless you're processing thousands of files at once, I wouldn't use the automated settings. I'd turn that off, make a new default. Which
right.
is easy to do in ACR, and turn them off.
Right.
And then what I would do, and it is what I've done in ACR, is I've created some slightly different default parameters that just suit the kind of images I normally make. And whereas with Capture...
So you've adjusted the different
yeah.
contrast or whatever, and you make a setting of that.
Yeah.
Say, okay,
and
I want a high contrast setting.
Things like exposure, I don't change. Brightness, I don't change. But the contrast level, I bump up just because...
Mm-hmm.
Or landscape stuff that I shoot, I like a little bit more contrast. Something closer to Velvia, though not as contrasty, more like a Provia or maybe even a notch down from there mm-hmm. as a starting point. So I make that adjustment because the original one is just a little bit flat for my taste. I bump up the shadow setting, which just also adds a little bit more punch. And my default that I've used, it varies over time, but it's somewhere between about 7 and 10. Is what I've used, and that just, like I said, adds a little bit more punch to the image. Now, that doesn't mean I leave the settings there. It just means that's where it starts, and oftentimes I don't have to tweak those, and that's great. I save a little bit of time.
Yep.
That's what it's all about.
At the bottom of the window, one of the things I like about ACR is that it lets you adjust what color space, so the color profile for the image, in which case I usually set mine to Adobe 1998,
yeah,
whether you want to output the file as a 16 or an 8-bit image.
And I pretty much always have it set on 16, unless I just know I'm not going to do any further mm-hmm. processing on it.
And you can adjust the image size,
right.
And I usually have it default to the full size, but if you wanted to make it, you could upsize, up-res it, or make it smaller.
Mm-hmm. And then it's got the typical eyedroppers
yep.
for doing things like white balance.
And it's got a crop tool and a
straightening tool.
You know, straighten, mm-hmm. which is good. And image rotate. So if you've got something
right.
in a landscape and you want to rotate it to
right.
portrait, you can do that.
And it's very easy to see if you've got some areas of blocked up shadows. That's usually not too bad a problem if it's just a little. or more importantly, burned out highlights. Those always look ugly.
So if you click the little shadows tab, and then it'll light up which channel, you know, the color, which channel you're blocking out those eyes. So I just click, I see some blue. That means I must be blocking up shadows in my blue channel.
Right. And then the analogous thing for highlights, you can see what's burned out. And ACR is one of the converters, I think it was the first one on the market, that allowed you to recover highlight detail.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a great thing. If you happen to have an image where you've got that spike on the right-hand side of the histogram and you've got an area of blocked up highlights, meaning that they're just all pure white and there's no detail there.
And you do that how?
You simply move the slider to the left.
The exposure slider.
I mean, yeah.
Right. So you're using the exposure tool. You move it to the left.
And you just watch the little histogram at the top.
Right.
And watch until the spike disappears.
Right.
And you'll see it.
And we should point out, I mean, this exposure tool was available in other programs, but it didn't always offer highlight recovery.
Exactly.
It would reduce the exposure of the other images, but it wouldn't bring back detail in the highlights.
Yeah, often what would happen is it would just make the whites gray.
Yeah, or God forbid some other weird color.
I've seen that happen too. Which is similar to what some of the other converters do, is it very often one of the channels is burned out, but there's image information in the other two, and it uses that to try to figure out what kind of detail to put in there. And you can absolutely recover detail that you couldn't have had in the past.
Certainly depends on how blown out your image was, but it works.
Yeah,
it works well.
Okay, let's look at the other settings.
The next pane is our detail pane.
Right, and one of the things that's on there is a sharpness slider. And think of this as a capture level sharpening. That's little c capture, not big C.
Right.
It means the first phase of sharpening that you do on the image.
This is to counteract the effects of your anti-aliasing filter on your camera.
Yeah, and then later on when you print it or if you send it off to the web, you'll want to do a little bit more sharpening. But that it's a two-step process. A lot of people are using two-step processes anymore. Some of the tools like PhotoKit Sharpener, which is an excellent sharpener, uses a two-stage process. It's not the only way to do it. Some people don't do any sharpening at all as part of the raw conversion, then save it all for the point where they do printing. There are theoretically some advantages in certain circumstances. And in fact, there are some advantages in certain circumstances. But for most normally sized prints, no big deal. So I typically do the two-step, and it starts with a default of 25. Now, one important thing is, although every camera that you open up in ACR will show a default of 25, in fact, the sharpening varies depending on the camera model. So there's some fancy things going on under the cover, and a D2X's sharpening will be different than a D70, for example.
Even if you're both set as 25,
right. And that's not a bad amount of sharpening for capture sharpening. It's not going to overdo it, but if you've listened to our other podcasts and we've talked a little bit about our default sharpening, it's a little bit less than that, our default sharpening within Capture. It's a little bit less than that, but not too bad, and it'll hold up pretty well to post-processing.
Right,
afterwards.
And you can, of course, play with it and see what you get.
Yeah,
if you crank it up all the way, you might start seeing some sharpening artifacts.
Yeah, just like all of them. It won't look
just,
good at that
just
setting.
Not a good idea.
But it's not a bad starting point. Now, what you do want to make sure of is that you have it set, if you want that capture sharpening, so that it's not just applying it to the preview, because it does give you that option of only sharpening the preview, and as soon as you leave ACR and you're into Photoshop, the sharpening's gone.
And you would use that because you're looking for details, judging your image to see if it's good, but you're going to do your sharpening using presumably you already have a sharpening workflow that you use in Photoshop already.
Right. Now, ACR is really nice in the respect that you can have all sorts of settings files and subsetting files and things like that. So if you wanted to, you could have several different levels of sharpening, capture sharpening.
And you just save a preset.
You know, one for portraits, one for landscapes that might be a little bit higher, things like that. You save a preset.
So what you're going to have to do if you're using ACR is to take advantage of those.
Right.
Play with it, get it something that you like, and then save that preset so you're not always reinventing the wheel.
Now, it's not a super zoomy sharpening thing where you can do selective things at different parts of the frame, But frankly, for most images I shoot, I don't need it.
And at stage one sharpening, you just want to sharpen everything in the frame.
Well, you know, sometimes if it's a higher noise thing and you're trying to save time, you may
But that'll be the topic of our sharpening workflow discussion.
Yeah. So for the basic stuff, it's pretty decent. Now, there's also a couple sliders for noise reduction on here.
Right.
There's a luminance smoothing and a color noise reduction. And it starts off with color noise reduction activated and set at 25. Now, that one is the same for every single camera. There's no tailoring for specific camera models. So you'll want to play with your own and try it at different ISOs and have different settings. And you'll want to see, do you want to use color noise reduction or do you want to use the luminance smoothing or a combination of the two? Just depends. For the D2X, I think we've talked about this before. It doesn't have that much of a problem with the color noise.
No.
So I tend to dial that down to zero and just do a little bit of luminance smoothing if I'm going to do it in ACR.
Right.
A lot of times I'll do it in Noise Ninja just because it has a little bit more.
Yeah. And if you've purchased that
fine variation,
you spent the money on a third-party plug-in for Photoshop to do noise removal, you know, you might not want to do much here.
Yeah, but it doesn't do a bad job. And for quick and simple stuff, it's fine. Now, you go over the lens tab, and it'll allow you to manually adjust the chromatic aberration control. So if you've got
color fringing.
Color fringing. Often in a wide-angle lens is when it shows up the most.
Especially in the edges or in backlit subjects.
Right. You can zoom in and do the two sliders, one that handles red cyan fringing, and then the other one that does blue and yellow, and you just play with those. It's really pretty obvious. Just start sliding them all over the place, and you'll see what it does. And then once you've found a setting that works well, if it's a fixed focal length lens,
you might just want to save
that setting file.
Yeah. Here's my 24 millimeter
and
lens
just,
setting.
Just save the chromatic aberration setting, and that alone, and it'll work well for others. For zoom, you might want a couple settings at least. And then it also has a vignetting control, so you can adjust darkening in the edges.
If you see some darkening in the corners.
Or add it if you want. You know, just
yeah,
as a
creative effect.
Right. Now,
moving
the
on.
Curve setting.
The curve tab.
Right.
This is where you adjust the tone curve of your image, which is related to contrast.
Right. And it comes with a few presets already with medium and strong. You can create others
linear.
If you want them. Yeah, linear.
Linear will give you a nice flat look.
It's a starting point, too,
if
you want to do
it. If you want to edit that, you can edit the curve manually. There's no little sliders at the bottom to edit levels, but you can totally tweak the curves, and it shows you the image histogram.
Right, and just like all the curves tools, you can do pseudo-levels things by dragging
the
corners
the corner
and pulling
points.
Them in. It's probably easier to do that on the exposure and shadow settings. And then finally, there's a calibrate tab. Now, this one has gotten a lot of discussion. It allows you to go in and adjust the hue and saturation of the three primary colors. So
red, green, and blue.
Yeah. So you can tweak that if you want. There are a lot of people that like going out and shooting color targets and then using these sliders to try to replicate exactly the colors on the color target. I don't know. Personally, I think that's a waste because I never bought slide film in the past because it had totally flat response. I usually bought the ones that didn't, you know, like Velvia.
I mean,
stuff.
Speakers, you want a flat response, but
yeah,
your film, you usually like a different
kind
of response.
There might be situations where you want to if you're recording something and want it to be, you know, super exact or come close to it. But I typically don't do that. You can use them as, you know, creative controls if you do want a little bit more saturation in one of the colors. I find it a little bit difficult to use that way. So while I've played around with it a lot and tried to do some things.
To me, this is the most intimidating panel in all of ACR.
I've
Everything else
to
is
do
pretty
some
straightforward.
To replicate the color mode 3 that I like really well with Capture that has the enhanced greens and reds. And I have not been able to quite get there. I'd like to get there because I like the workflow in ACR and it would be really nice in some circumstances. But I just haven't come up with anything that's quite the same.
Right.
Let's see. Other things that we should talk about. Oh, you know, when you are in Bridge, it gives you some nice options. You don't have to go all the way into Photoshop to edit your RAW files. You can just...
You can pull up camera
RAW. Right-click them. Or
copy-paste settings.
Yeah, I think a Control-R thing on
and your
Windows
presets
PCs.
Come up in the drop-down menu when you right-click.
Yeah,
you're saved. Too.
But you can also just bring up the window and not bring up the rest of Photoshop. Mm-hmm. So you can go through a whole bunch of images really quickly. Just open up Camera Raw, adjust them, copy them, shut it down. Just save the settings. And then if you're doing a whole bunch of files, which that approach works well with, and you're using CS2, you can use an automation tool called Image Processor. Shows up, I think, under the Automate thing under File. And then it'll allow you to select a whole bunch of images and bridge and then process them with the settings that you've put into the files or another setting file and generate JPEGs and TIFFs, etc. I think it'll do DNG files too. We'll talk about that in a sec. You know, just all one batch sequence. So that's pretty cool. So again, you know, I think if you're doing a lot of files, it's pretty cool.
It's very good.
It's got one of the better workflows now. It's partially because I've used it a lot.
Mm-hmm.
Some of the other ones that we've talked about have good workflows too, but I think ACR is definitely one of the best in my mind. We talked a little bit about DNG, and let's just talk about that.
That's a new file format that Adobe came out with
about
a year or so ago.
Yeah,
a little longer than that, maybe.
It's been out for a little while now. And the whole point is to get kind of a wrapper around proprietary file formats, whether they're Nikon NEF files or a Canon file or whatever, that looks about the same and that different...
That in theory, you could have a DNG decoder, and I could send you a file from a Canon camera and an Olympus camera.
It's an attempt at a standard format. One nice thing about it is those sidecars that we were talking about earlier, the small files with the setting parameters, end up getting... Or at least there's an option for embedding them
within the DNG files,
and that way they're together. So if you're not going to lose your settings
with the I think we talked about in the last episode, possibly, I'm not sure, or a few episodes ago. If you use sidecar files, the advantage is they really speed up your workflow. The downside is that if you're going to archive your RAWs with this added information, don't forget to copy that information.
Don't forget
to copy the sidecar files over too. Otherwise, the program's it's going to start you from scratch again, and you have to reprocess the file.
Yeah, I honestly haven't used the DNG files. I just haven't felt compelled, but a lot of people do like that. And
it's a good idea.
Option. Yeah, DxO does that too, and it'll probably show up with some of the other ones over time. I think that's about it. You know, like a lot of the converters, the image quality that you get out of is dependent on how you use it, how well you know it, how much time you've invested in it. And I think it's important to set up some of those settings files for your own tastes.
Because clearly, if you just use the defaults with the auto everything, you're going to get some whacked out looking files.
Yeah, absolutely.
And that's not good. I've run into some strange things every now and then where I don't find the reds match the red tones that I do when I process a file elsewhere. But
they
I can get around it. I mean, I can certainly deal with
RAW,
that.
Think of RAW converters in some ways as being like film types. And
They
all have a little bit different color palette, different contrast handling. You know, they'll respond to the shadows a little bit differently, a little bit differently to the highlights. So one thing that's important is find something that you like.
Mm-hmm.
Because if it doesn't take a lot of settings in order to get the thing that you like, you can produce images pretty quickly with it. Conversely, if you're tweaking it to death, it may not be the best choice for you. And that only comes through a little bit of trial and error. So as we've mentioned before, download these things, try them. Now, if you have CS2 or Elements, you've already got it. So go ahead and give it a shot. But don't just use the default parameters.
And make sure you download the latest version from Adobe.
Yeah, good point too.
Because if you have an earlier version of Photoshop, like, for example, Photoshop CS, you can use Camera Raw 2.x. I don't know what the last version was. It is not compatible with Camera Raw 3.0 and higher.
And more importantly, it won't work with certain Nikon bodies.
Right, and so as Camera Raw evolves, so does... as Photoshop evolves, so does Camera Raw. Mm-hmm. And for reasons, for whatever, Adobe did not make Camera Raw a standalone application. It only works with certain. So you need either Photoshop Elements 4 or Photoshop CS2 to use the latest version of Adobe Camera Raw. Mm-hmm. So for right now, that's no big deal, at least for me. But it was certainly for me a year ago, it was a compelling reason for me to upgrade to Photoshop CS2 from CS1.
Right. Me too.
Because it was ACR3 that would read the D2X.
Yeah, and it happens
files.
With all the software packages.
Yeah, I mean, that's just...
It's fair. They can only maintain old ones for so long.
Exactly.
It becomes expensive.
Get legacy
for the company, and
support.
And they want you to buy new ones, but
sure.
I mean, it's pretty reasonable. They all do it.
So the biggest difference with ACR and everybody else is that it doesn't save the file when you're done. It sends the file into Photoshop.
Right.
From which point you can save it as a Photoshop file or a TIFF or a JPEG or whatever. So it still requires that other application. It sort of assumes that you're going to throw the image in there. So,
yeah, for some things it just assumes you will complete the work in Photoshop.
Yes, it's
and since it's part of the
that.
Same package, fairly
makes sense.
Reasonable
I mean,
thing.
It's a fair assumption.
Yeah, it does have some ramifications on things like file size and whatever. One of the cool things about NX that we found is the file sizes can be lower if you're doing things that are equivalent to layers. Now, and if you're using ACR and then putting it into Photoshop and doing those same things, the file sizes can grow a bit.
Especially if you're working in 16-bit.
Yeah.
I mean, that's where it can be big. But, you know, if you were... So as what we would think, if you, you know, if you're already very familiar with Photoshop and you want to do your editing in Photoshop, then ACR is a great way because it's going to put your file right into Photoshop
for
you.
It's very integrated.
It's right there for you. I can think of no better integrated Photoshop workflow. The only other program that we tested that puts itself into Photoshop sort of as a plug-in is Bibble. Mm-hmm. So that's another option. But,
right.
You know, so, you know, we're coming to the close of our discussion on raw converters. You know, what have we learned from all of this? You know, what can we take home?
Yeah, you know, what's funny is I feel like I'm in about the same position that I started, which was that in general, I'm going to still use Capture, you know, whether it's the older version or the newer NX one as it develops. And, you know, there's still a few bugs in NX. You know, there were a few things in the release that we didn't see in the last beta. That happened.
It just happens.
You know, I mean, that stuff happens. It'll get fixed. So, I'm, you know, for a lot of stuff, I'm going to continue to do that. And frankly, it's for one simple reason. The color palette that I get with Mode 3 is something I like a lot, and it's so easy for me just to
you
get
just
to
click
that
mode
point.
3.
I have to do very, very little right. editing of most images, and they just they look pretty good.
Mm-hmm.
For higher volume stuff, I'll probably still lean to ACR. I don't do a lot of high volume stuff, but when I do, it's pretty nice. And frankly, if all I had was ACR, I'd probably be fine.
Oh, yeah, there's certainly no reason to...
Like I said, it's just the ease of the color palette.
So what our advice would be, think about your workflow. Think about the features that set that you want. I mean, money is going to be a factor.
Right.
You got to buy these programs one way or another. I mean, that's, you know, at some point you're going to have to invest in some of this. I mean, if you've already plunked down the money for Photoshop CS2, then, you know, maybe you don't want to spend another $100 on a raw converter because you can get ACR. That makes a lot of sense.
Yeah.
But whatever one you do, we said it before, we'll say it again, learn how to use your raw converter.
Yeah, don't just take a few hours and then draw conclusions from them.
A few days. I mean,
right.
the
We've
fact
been
of the matter
these
is
for months now, and we're just scratching the surface of some of them.
And there's going to be people who really know their stuff better than we do and who will tell you, oh, well, this is everything you can do. They're right. They're not wrong that you couldn't do it in another program, but the point is that you learn it, you start getting familiar with it, you start unleashing the power of it, and that's never going to happen if you just bounce around between products.
Yeah, one thing I will say for sure, there is no such thing as the best converter.
No, there's converters that do good jobs at certain things, maybe not as good jobs at other things, but you are the judge as to whether or not those pluses and minuses are weaknesses or strengths to you.
Right.
What might be of strength to me could be a weakness to you, and therefore we could have a vastly different opinion. Yeah. And the answer is neither of us would be wrong because we'd both have a product in our own workflow that we've worked out
right.
that works for us, and that's really what's important.
Yeah. So the only way to really determine that is try them yourself. Give them some time.
And, you know, with the exception of Well, I don't know. Is there a downloadable trial of Photoshop or Elements that you can do?
You know, I think there is. We didn't check on that.
But, you know, for all of these other ones, for the most part, the companies offer some kind of trial download where you can just see, even if you can't evaluate all of the features, you can start seeing how easy it is or not to get an image effect that you like. How well does it perform on your computer? Do you have an older computer or a brand new top-end machine with tons of RAM? I mean, that's going to make maybe need to be factored into your decision. Mm-hmm. So try the trial versions of these things and get them.
Yeah. All right. I think that does it.
So next time, what are we going to try to talk about?
I have no idea. Oh, I do.
Oh, good. Good, because I don't have an idea.
I'm going to slap my head here. Flash.
Oh, that's right. Yeah. We've had some requests on
We're going to talk about ITTL
Digital Flash
in particular and some of the little helpful hints that will get you better looking flash exposures and some of the creative things that you can do.
Disclaimer, we're not Joe McNally. We're not,
but we'll try.
ITTL gurus.
Yeah, we'll try. We'll pretend at the very least.
That's definitely on our list. So we're going to try to talk about Flash. We're also going to try to have an episode coming up shortly. I don't know about next time, but at least in the next couple of weeks here on sharpening.
Right.
That's the other one.
The black art of sharpening.
Yes, and it's an interesting thing. We might spend a whole show on that one.
We could.
So anyway, we hope you've enjoyed the show today. Don't forget to tune in another 2 weeks for our next episode over at podcasts.nikonians.org. Or just subscribe using your RSS reader or
right.
iTunes.
And if you do get a chance, do vote for us over at Podcast Alley.
Absolutely.
We haven't mentioned that in a while, but that's a nice thing.
And see you over in the discussion forums, and we'll be looking forward to getting some email from you. Right. Okay, see you next time.
Bye-bye.